Life can be an extraordinary adventure. More than ordinary. In the gym. At home. At work. More than ordinary. Advice. Without the new agey bullshit.
Welcome to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
I'm Anne-Marie DeMars.
And joining us today is so many hyphenates, I feel like it can't even start, but Jonathan Shaw, who's an author, a tattoo artist, like I said, it goes on and on and on. First, we just really wanted to jump into it, but I guess first, thanks so much for being here.
And thanks so much for having me. That's my line.
You're an author. It's kind of what you've been doing for the last... How long would you say you've been an author?
Well, it's a weird definition, author, because it's like they say you're an author once you become published or a certain level of recognition or whatever. But I mean, if an author is just somebody that writes compulsively, obsessively, all the time, I've been an author, I guess, since I was like 14 years old. And I always read a lot, so I always dreamed of actually publishing books and manifesting something in that department, but it was a long, twisted path before I actually became like an author, quote unquote. So I guess I've been laboring consciously for about 20 years with the definite idea of putting together a series of books that I knew I would publish someday. But it really started when I was like 14 because I just wrote and read.
And I wonder, having read your book, and I was telling Maria that now I can definitely claim that I'm not the worst mother of anybody that we have met. And if you are questioning how I could say that to a guest, like I said, you should read his book. I wonder if that writing, in a way, was that cathartic? Was it a way for you to deal with things?
Oh, my God. There's nothing more cathartic than going through the incidents of the confluence of circumstances that sort of all fall together to make up this sort of patchwork quilt of a life. There's nothing more cathartic than going over all those circumstances in writing. For me, that's like my religion. Because you, for many reasons, but I think the one thing that's really powerful about the spoken word and thereby the written word is that you somehow, in that process, you sort of have this, the privilege or the honor or the grace of being able to remove yourself, the little self, the egoic self, from the story. So at some point, it come to a place of objectivity about, you know, all sorts of really emotionally charged things, people, places, events, situations, your emotions, and you can divorce yourself. You can sort of remove yourself on some level, on some psychic level, from those happenings in a way that is really just such a blessing to be able to see one's life as if they were watching some really weird movie. Sometimes it's a horror film, what's going to come out of the closet, and then sometimes it's a beautiful thing, you know. But whatever it is, the writing, at some point, I think if a writer is working with consciousness, and is producing work with authenticity and integrity, there's got to be a point in that process where the writer suddenly becomes like the observer of himself, in a sense that he's not attached to that self, which is a total blessing, because that is where the catharsis takes place. It takes place in the fact that, like, oh, this shit happened. Oh, I was, neglected or abused or emotionally damaged as a child. So fucking what? It's like, get over it. We're telling a story here. I write, by the grace of God, I've been able to write a lot of stuff about myself as if I was writing fiction. And looking at that guy, who is not attached to the guy I am today, thanks God, you know, I can actually look at all that stuff. And there has to be, that's where like an element of humor comes into the thing. That's where an element of like theater of the absurd comes into the thing. Like, people have asked me, you know, how do you define, what genre do you work in? Because journalists, they like to pigeonhole things into genres and stuff like that, definitions that, you know, are sort of like easy to digest for those who don't want to have to think too much. And in that sense, they ask what genre, and I'm like, I've invented my own genre. It's called slapstick tragedy. And that just stuck. That was during an interview somewhere, and then I was just like, oh, that's cool. I can use that. You know, I'll genrefy myself as a slapstick tragedist.
Well, and that was one of the things that interested me a lot as a writer, is you have so many different perspectives in this one book. I read Scab Vendor, which is your upcoming, kind of your first part of your memoir. You know, and there were so many different perspectives. And when you were going into it, did you think, I'm going to approach it from this perspective? Or did it just come as you were writing it? How did that come about?
That's a really great question. And it's a really organic process. You know, for me, I can't speak for other writers because everybody's got their training and their whatever. But for me as a writer, it was completely random. It was like running through some big, weird, surreal open field with like butterfly net, just trying to catch stuff out of the air as I went along. And some of these things were like beautiful butterflies, and some of them were like poisonous creatures that wanted to eat me or whatever, you know. But it was really organic, and really sort of, there was no real forethought to this any more than one would put a great deal of forethought into like projectile vomiting, you know, their soul, you know, into a sea. So in that sense, but, you know, that's the writing process. For me, there's two very distinct processes. There's the writing process, there's the vomiting process, as it were, and then there's the editorial process. My training is an editor. I worked for years in magazines, and I've read a bazillion books. So, you know, I have the editorial sort of second sense. But as a writer, my philosophy is just let it flow, just spit it out, spill it all.
Well, and we just kind of jumped into talking to you, but I wanted to have a true confession here. So when Pete told me, oh, you've got to talk to my friend Jonathan Shaw, I looked you up on the internet, source of all knowledge, right? And there was the Jonathan Shaw, who was the really famous tattoo artist and edited the magazine on tattoos and all that. And then there was the Jonathan Shaw, who was the writer. And then there was the Jonathan Shaw, who was the son of like the super famous band leader back in the day. And he had a child with this actress. And I was wondering, which one is it that is Pete's friend? And then I realized as I looked into it more that they're the same person. So does that happen to you a lot, where people thought, wait a minute, I thought those were two different people and they're both you, or they're all three you?
That's interesting. I never thought of that, really, honestly. I mean, not in that sense that it would actually like confuse people, but the fact is, I've lived a sort of schizophrenic lifestyle. I mean, a life. I say that in a colloquial term because I'm not pretending to understand psycho terminology. But, you know, I've lived many lives within one life. And in that, that's nothing that was I ever thought about or tried to create or invent. It just happened. You know, I was sort of saw myself as like this pinball just shooting across and then hitting this post and then shooting, you know, being shuttled over to another post and then back across to the other one, almost in a sense as if I didn't even have any control over it. Like I was just this thing being like just batted around. And in the batting process, you know, I kind of got good at navigating all the little posts and, you know, places, but I never thought of myself as this, that, or the other. My saving grace, I think, you know, as a writer and just as a human being on some levels, is I've never believed my own press. I mean, I'm a gypsy, you know. I come from Rom culture in the sense that my grandfather, my mother's father, was like full-blooded Rom. And I wasn't raised with these values, but it just seemed to be sort of like woven somewhere into my DNA in a way that just made me really comfortable just sort of being a passenger of destiny or something. All these different incarnations or personas or masks that I've been presented with to wear at different times, different stages of my journey are kind of incidental, you know. They're just kind of like a change of clothes for the soul. And so one day you might just get up and put on a suit and tie, and the next day you might put on a motorcycle jacket, and the next day you might wear a Speedo and go jump in the ocean, depending on your circumstances. So in that sense, yeah, I never thought about this. And they all sort of now, at this stage of my life, I'm 64 now, you know, and at this particular juncture in my life, I see where all these different ingredients and pieces of the jigsaw puzzle are all starting to come together to form kind of like a self-portrait. And that's why I'm so compelled to write these books, to tell all these different stories, because I'm just sharing my experience with whoever might want to read it. I'm not really doing it, you know, with the idea of like, oh, I must tell this story so that people can understand. It's just something I got to do. Because if I don't do it, I'll just dry up and blow away, spiritually, emotionally. And so it's become a practice, and it's part of the thing. But now, It's like I'm going out and I'm talking to people a lot because I've written a few books and people have read them and they're like, oh my God, this guy's twisted or he's cool or he's, you know, wise or he's an idiot or whatever they want to think about me. They want to talk to me suddenly. You know, suddenly I'm going all over the place and being interviewed and they're sending me all over the world and I'm doing a lot of press. And in that context, I'm getting to interact with a lot of my fellow human beings in a context based on my experience. I feel a great responsibility to be honest, to be forthcoming, to be available, to be vulnerable, and to tell the truth as I've experienced it. Because in some way, I think that's what brings people together is just these stories. Stories are really powerful. Stories are super powerful. Like the, you know, the story Pete told about Rhonda in the making of that movie, that's one point of perspective to the Rhonda story. I'm sure any subject of a documentary, because I'm being subjected to a documentary film crew myself right now, and I know that any subject of a documentary must, you know, you can only show like the little point of the iceberg. You can only show that much.
Right. Maria and Rhonda wrote this book, My Fight, Your Fight, and their view on certain things and my view of the same things were not always identical.
I was merely the conduit through which the words were being written. but I had a question, though. I mean, talking about perspectives and also reading your book, I mean, you're very open about a lot of things. It doesn't seem like you felt a need to filter. But were there things where you felt like maybe with regard to not yourself, you know, other people? This is one of the things that we ran into when we were doing it. You don't want to burn other people in telling your story. Was there considerations about that, or how does that factor in? I know some of it says some of the characters are kind of combinations of people, a couple of
them. Yeah, composites and so forth. But no, that wasn't really necessarily why I created composite characters. That was not the reason. You know, I spare no one, especially myself. First of all, myself. Take no prisoners, and that must include me. So I'm brutally self-critical. And if I'm going to do that, there might be a few people that are mortally offended by stories that I've told. Tough shit. It's like in the quest for authenticity and integrity, you know, I tell it as it is. If somebody doesn't like that, I'm not here to please anybody, including myself. I'm not here to paint a pleasant picture. My quest, I think it has been on some weird level ever since I was hatched, has always been to find the truth, whatever that might be. You know, I still have no friggin' idea what the truth is, but I'm looking for it. I'm searching, I'm looking down under the surface of things. And, you know, I'm the first to accept that my vision of things is most likely really disturbed and demented and colored by that disturbance and dementia. I make that very clear in writing right at the outset of the book. It's like, my life is a hallucination to me. God only knows what it's going to be to anybody that happens to delve into it. But yeah, there's people that I told stories about, Arthur Janoff specifically, Primal Scream guy. I mean, I was not kind to old Arthur.
You were not kind to a number of people, let's be honest here. I read your book.
Okay, let's hear it.
Well, for example, you know, the way that you talked about your mom, and that it sounds like from the book that she was pretty much a raging alcoholic. I mean, she tried to, shoot two husbands?
No, well, she shot one. Well, she tried to shoot one. That was my father. And the other one, she bashed him over the head with a marble lampstand, which was a lot more painful than what my father got. My father, you know, she missed. Thank God she wasn't much of a shot.
Oh, well, that makes her a good mom then. She shot at your dad, but she missed.
But you see, I never portrayed her as evil. I mean, in the book, I said she was a broken person. She was and I even went and talked about how her upbringing. Remember that part when I talked about her growing up with the gypsy? And then I was like, Jesus, I thought I had it bad as a kid.
No, you didn't portray her as evil, but you didn't portray her as mother of the year either.
No, of course not. Why would I? She was a sick, twisted, demented individual who was not evil, who had a great deal of love in her heart, and I acknowledged that. I have nothing but love and appreciation and forgiveness for my mother. That doesn't mean I'm going to polish a turd when I talk about her. Whatever I say, when I tell the truth about people, the good, the bad, and the ugly, including myself, it's always with a great respect. There's compassion. Compassion is not always like it's all good. You know, I forgive you. Whatever you did, whoever you are, I forgive you. That doesn't mean we're going to be doing lunch next Wednesday. One must look at things as they are. So, yeah, of course I told the truth about my mother as I experienced. My father, my stepfather, I really put him through the coals. my Uncle Ivan, so many people. I mean, yeah, a lot of people, but most of all myself. Yeah, I mean, you got to just tell things as you experience them, as you emotionally. That's really important to me. So yeah, I was brutal, everything, because I've lived a brutal life, and I'm happy for it.
Yeah, well, one thing that jumped out to me was there wasn't like a lot of blaming in the book. I mean, one of the lines that I jumped out and I even wrote down was, not once did I ever stop to consider that the real problem in any relationship was me.
Boom.
And I think sometimes people are reading and they're trying to figure out what's going on, why are all these things happening, and kind of that moment of, it's not everyone else's fault. Sometimes it's your own fault, whoever you happen to be in the story.
Sure. In my world, there's no victims. There's only volunteers. Now, that might sound really extreme if you start to think about beaten women, abused children, but, you know, I'll go into some very far out areas, you know, of past life, karma.
Having some experience with child abuse? I might say differently than that, and I do agree with a certain extent, and I like that line, that there's no victims, they're just volunteers. I have a friend who is a college president at a tribal college on an Indian reservation, and he used to say that for almost every problem you find yourself with in life, you can trace back to at some point you could have made a different decision and you wouldn't be here. But, you know, as far as children being beaten and abused, I tend to try to believe that everything happens for a reason. And so sometimes those kids who are beaten, and one of the few lines I know from anything remotely resembling classic literature, Hemingway said that you go stronger in the broken places. So sometimes those kids that got beat up when they were young grow up and go into boxing or wrestling or judo, and they become real champions because they've learned to survive under tough circumstances.
Absolutely. And don't get me wrong, I'm no advocate of any kind of suffering for any human being, man, woman, child, or animal. Au contraire. But I do believe, as somebody who suffered a lot of abuse and emotional trauma as a child, I'm so grateful today that I had the parents that I had, that I had the upbringing that I had, that I suffered those traumas, that I survived those things, and somehow evolved into a somewhat conscious human being that's trying to contribute something, that is contributing something of value to this messed up world. That is something just to be eternally grateful for. So, you know, I can only speak for myself, but I've known a lot of people who've been through literal hell, and some don't make it. Some just turn weird and get weirder and self-destruct. They go up in flames. Members of my own family that I've written about couldn't survive the pain, the suffering, the trauma, the whatever. Others that I've known and continue to know and feel honored to know are people who've suffered trauma and abuse beyond even anything that I can compare to, and they're like some of the most highly principled, honest, straight-up, stand-up people. They're just fighting to bring goodness into the world.
We'll be right back.
You can be too successful.
How so?
Our latest games have parents suggesting we get endorsements from YouTube celebrities, have professional gamers stream us on Twitch. They point out where we aren't the virtual reality level of Call of Duty.
Yet.
The point is, our games are so much more, well, game-like than the average educational games that people forget that what you really should be comparing these games to are math worksheets.
Yeah, I mean, you can have your kids sit down and do math workbooks for 20 minutes, if you can even get them to do that. Or you can let them play Fish Lake, which they'll probably ask you to let them keep playing after 20 minutes.
Or you can play yourself. You know you are never going to pick up one of those workbooks again for the rest of your life. Still, do you remember how to reduce fractions to lowest terms, multiply and divide fractions?
If not, play Fish Lake before Mia or Connor or Aiden or Joe gets home from school and asks for your help with their homework. Welcome back to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm still Anne-Marie DeMars, and we still have with us...
Jonathan Shaw here at your cervix.
Yeah, like I said, I went through it, read your book. I thought it was great. And especially what I liked is it picked up pace as it went on. Or maybe it was just as a reader, I got more and more into it. But as also a writer, I had a couple of questions that I really just wanted to ask. And the first one was, editing. Now, you know, as somebody who wrote a book that was close to 300 pages myself, there's a lot more that goes into it. She always uses this phrase, you know, writing is an art, publishing is a business. But there's also a lot of dynamics between a writer and an editor. And I was wondering what your relationship was like with your editor in terms of writing the book. I mean, sometimes they come back and they make things a lot better. And sometimes there's a back and forth where you just are glad you're not in the same room because you can just walk away.
So I ran this through half a dozen really close friends and used them as editors, chiefly because I couldn't afford to pay a real bona fide editor. So anyway, it went through a lot of editorial revisions, and that was actually part of the writing process, because at some point I vomited out all this stuff, but then at some point I had to start juxtaposing stuff and shuffling stuff around and cutting stuff out and adding more stuff and doing some more research in here, and then, oh wait, I forgot all about that. And then it became like a patchwork quilt. And at some point, the creative process, the writing, the vomiting process sort of joined forces with the editorial process. And then this crazy, wild child, idiot savant spitting all this material out came to a place where he was able to work in collaboration with a very methodical, sort of pragmatic editor guy. And these two entities existed within my own self. And so I did edit this book like insanely compulsively for a long time. And then when the publishing deal finally came together, my experience with publishing was that my first book was made in a similar fashion. And that book went to HarperCollins and they were just like, great, print it. They don't spend a fucking dime to buy cat piss to pour on your head if you caught fire. That's HarperCollins, and that's pretty much goes for all the big publishers. They will not. You thought Potty Mouth Pete was bad.
Oh, no, Pete's way better than me. I'm on my best behavior today.
So, I don't even have Tourette's. It's just literary Tourette's. That's me. Maybe that's why we get along so good. It's Potty Mouth Pete, shit-eating Shaw, you know. So HarperCollins, they wouldn't spend a dime on an editor. So I had to really make that book tight as a cat's ass before I could give it to them. And then I don't think they gave a shit anyway, because Johnny Depp had come along and put his seal of approval on it. Shh, it's cool. So they were just like, oh, Johnny Depp says it's cool, so let's just print it. It could have been anything, I think, as far as they cared. They're bean counters. They're not creative people. And so they sent me the stuff, you know, copy edit, that's a whole other thing. But there was no input from an editor, the kind of stuff I would get from my friends and literate people. They were just like, oh, copy edit this thing and print it. So I was kind of expecting the same thing and kind of dreading the same thing from a new publisher, but I already made a vow that I would never again publish with a big publisher, because they don't do shit for you. They don't do anything editorially for you. They don't do anything promotionally for you. It's just you have the prestige of being able to say, oh, my first book came out on HarperCollins, you know, so I must be cool or something. That's the impression. But it's nothing like that. They're scum. They don't do anything. They don't care. So I got an agent, you know, after going through like three bottom-feeding literary agents, I finally found an agent who actually gives a shit, who cares, who's really a good guy and doesn't give a shit about the money. He wants to do stuff that counts. And this is like a rarity in that business, too. And he explained to me, yeah, that's kind of how it works. So let's find you a publisher that's going to actually give you some juice, even if they're small, but let's get you with some people that give a shit. So he got me this next publishing deal. And with these guys, it was a whole different experience. Suddenly, you know, I get my book back with all kinds of critical editorial notes from a real editor that I, you know, somebody that they paid to edit my book properly. The editor was not intrusive. He wasn't trying to put his ego into the thing. He was just fact-checking, and he was cleaning things up, and he was helpful in every single way. There was nothing, there was no dispute, there was no clash of ideas. I was like, oh shit, I never thought of that. Thank you. We'll change that. Oh, that date conflicts with this happening. Oh my God, no, you know. So there was stuff that really could have been embarrassing in the book, just logistically, if this guy hadn't gone through it.
I guess I was really lucky because I wrote a book that was not nearly as famous as yours or Maria's. And I did it with Black Belt Books. It was just on judo called Waiting on the Ground. And my editor was a lot like the one you mentioned, where she would say things, well, I'm not sure how you got from this position to that position, or I can't really see what your hand's doing here, or it's not clear to me. So I guess I was really lucky. That was my one and only experience, and it was good.
Me too. I guess I was lucky.
Well, so we got really lucky with our book editor, but there was definitely this thing where it's almost in a way, this is your baby or this is your big thing you've been working on. Sometimes then someone comes in and they have all these ideas, and ultimately you just hope that you get an editor that's going to make it better at the end.
There are real good, I lied, because when I wrote Narcissa, even though I did a lot of editorial on it myself, at some point during the process, that was like a 4-year writing process and editing process, at some point I actually scraped together a few $1,000 and I hired an editor. And she came back and she gave me the most amazing input. But then I took her input and extrapolated on it because I couldn't afford to pay her another few $1,000. So I just took this gold that she gave me and I started building on it. And then I extrapolated from there. And suddenly I just sort of almost started channeling her. And then I just was like, oh, what would she say? And then I wound up just giving Narcissa another million edits. And it came out to be a really good thing.
I also had a question. So you have these journals, it seems, that you had kept for years and years, and you pull from them in the book. And one of the things that I was really interested in is reading back over them when you were going back through them. I mean, some of it are literally, and this is kind of a random example, but it will get back to it. I just remember being in college and someone was saying, oh yeah, I'm going to go write this paper and I'm so high right now. And the next day we were like, oh, so how'd your paper come out? And you know, he was like, it's coming together so well. And then the next day he was like, oh my God, it made absolutely no sense whatsoever. So were there parts of it as you went through these journals? I mean, because some of the writing in there, it was clearly you were doing a lot of drugs at the time and things. Were there parts where you just got into it and you were like, oh my, what? None of this makes any sense? Or did it come back in this weird way? Or what was that like?
Well, that was an interesting thing. That's a great question, because that's an interesting thing. Like people, it's weird. Like I realized I had to be much older and much more experienced and sober and conscious to go back into those old mummy chambers, those old journals that I unearthed in the process of writing this thing and going through all that stuff. And I was like, damn, this kid had a spark of genius in him. He could write. I'm looking at this like it was just written by some, you know, guy who died 40 years ago or something. And I'm reading through this stuff and I'm going, shit, this isn't bad. It just needs to be edited a little bit. It needs to be cleaned up and refined, and we could slip this in here and slip this in there. So a lot of the writing actually wasn't bad, but it was bad because I was bad, basically. You know, I was an insane person, drugged out of my skull. But the writing was actually, I think I might have written better stuff back then when I was like this stoned out 16-year-old than I could possibly write today. But the important ingredient was that I was able to go back there as a sober, conscious guy and sift through all this stuff and be able to almost resurrect something that was lost, something that should have been lost, something that should have been dead, something that should have been totally destroyed, and it wasn't. So it was almost like my job to go back there and go, okay, kid, come on, it's all right, I got you, you know, and sort of refine that stuff and put it to good use, use it to good purpose as part of this ongoing thing. Just like I used letters from my dead cousin Malcolm, God rest his soul, and
well, yeah, the stories
letters.
Your uncle had written, too.
The stories my uncle had written. I mean, what a friggin' genius that guy was. But he never published a thing because he couldn't even sit up straight. He was so drunk. But he was a genius. He poured all this stuff out, and then I was able to resurrect that and redeem it. And I feel like, you know, I was able to tell his stories and sort of lend some compassion to the kid who he was and who my mother was when they grew up with this raging, insane, fighting crazy gypsy with that story where he gets into it with the cops. I mean, that's one of the most brutal things I've ever read.
Yeah, I winced just reading it.
I mean, that's some brutal shit. So of course in the course of that, you know, I'm writing with a lot of compassion for those four kids, my mother and her siblings, that grew up in this tornado of violence and insanity. It's a testament to the power of their souls that they even made it as far as they did. I mean, my mother died at a ripe old age, completely pickled in booze, but she, despite all her many flaws as an insane person, she was a strong spirit. And the same goes for all those siblings and that whole family, all those people, all those suicides. It's like there's a nobility in there of the struggle, kind of like these trouts trying to swim upstream, you know, against this raging waterfall current. Bear sitting there snatching one over here and snatching one over there and chopping its head off. But the ones that make it to the top, it's like, are up there to honor those that didn't, just by virtue of their struggle and their effort to survive in a really adversarial environment, yeah.
Well, and your book covers about the first 20 years of your life, is that right?
Yeah.
And so this question kind of comes after, but it's also kind of addressed very early in the book when, because part of it's a little bit kind of, I don't know if present's the word, but more contemporary, you know, when you're writing it. You were at the height of your tattoo career, kind of in a lot of ways, and you just walked away. What was that like? I mean, did you ever look back at that? It was just kind of a, you've talked a lot about, you know, you just kind of ping pong ball around, but what was that decision like to just, you know what, I'm out.
Yeah, that's a question I've had to ask myself over and over, and I've got different answers to that. One of them is the most obvious one. My father did the exact same thing. So it's in your DNA. You can do what you want, but there's no escaping that DNA, man. So my father did the same damn thing. So, I mean, that was already kind of programmed into my DNA, but then when it actually happened, it seemed not only the most logical and most effortless thing in the world, but it seemed like literally my survival depended on that, because what happened was I reached a turning point, and in subsequent books, it's going to get into more detail about that all happened. But what happened was the height of my fame and prestige and whatever as a tattoo guy, I crashed and burned and died 1,000 deaths because I've been sober for a number of years. Not really sober, just stark raving sober. I wasn't on any kind of sustainable sobriety path, but I was a crazy person. I was violent and volatile and angry and just confused as hell. And eventually I relapsed and drank again. And then I started like really the slow descent. And by the end of 4 years of what they would call relapse, alcoholic relapse, you know, I found myself really circling the drain. And still that wasn't enough to stop me. And I just kept circling the drain until I found myself in a situation where I was literally at death's door. Literally. I mean, I was dying. I knew I was about to die. And I said, please, God, help me. That's probably the most honest, sincere prayer I've ever said. Because I've said a lot of prayers over the years, some pretty fancy ones too. But that, just that, as I was going down and losing consciousness, I was like, please, God, help me. Boom. I woke up like an hour later. My head had hit the toilet with such force that it cracked the porcelain bowl, not to mention my skull. Blood everywhere. And I sort of woke up in this pile of water and blood, and I looked around and I said, where am I? Am I alive? And I was like, had my eyes closed, and I was just looking around, and I was like, hello? Hello? Is anybody there? Yeah, I thought I was like died and gone to hell. I was like wandering around in the darkness, and then I started to come to, and I realized, oh shit, I'm alive. I've got a second chance. Oh, I asked God to help me. Oh, I guess he means business. And from that day on, I had a complete psychic change that had to be followed up by years and years and years of really intense therapy and work and shamanistic seeking and dedication to really transforming like a broken life into something that I could possibly convert into something sustainable. So that was the big turning point. And in the midst of that big psychic, emotional, spiritual sort of awakening, I realized, oh, if I keep living the way I've lived before, I'm going to get the same results. So everything has to change, everything. So slowly but surely, I just started getting rid of everything that might potentially stand in the way of my survival as a recovered drug addict, alcoholic, abuse survivor, whatever you want, children of alcoholics, whatever. I just started jettisoning stuff that might impede my survival because I was trying to get up to the surface and I got all this baggage and weight on me. I'm starting to throw off the boots and the leather jacket because I'm going down. And so it was kind of like, it was a no-brainer.
Yeah, well, I was saying when I was telling her earlier, I said, you know, when I finished your book, and basically, first book, it ends, but like, we know there's a lot more years to come. My first thought was, boy, I hope it gets better for him from here on out. But we knew coming in today, especially, you know, you're friends with Pete, and obviously he's not going to send us a completely crazy, drugged out person at our door. So we knew it was going to get better. But it's kind of one of those where it's this uncertainty tugging at your heart, hoping it works out kind of moment there.
Right. Well, the Cigano character, the Jonathan Shaw character, whatever that I portray in that book, as he is in sort of real time and he's talking to this kid, that guy is you know, he's, what, like a year or two sober. He's just starting to find his sea legs and be like, oh, can I do this? He's still very emotionally charged and conflicted, and he's skittish. He's not grounded in his recovery yet, but he knows that that's what he has to devote his life to. So that's kind of how I was when I was a year or two sober. I was stark raving sober, you know. I mean, I think I'm a lot kinder, gentler, more lucid human being now. It's been almost 17 years. So the great honor of that is that I was thinking this as I came down here. I'm riding a motorcycle down here, and usually when I'm riding the motorcycle, I'm either thinking, cursing other people, or praying. So I try to pray a lot. So as I was praying, I started saying, oh, thank you for allowing me to somehow internalize, like on a really deep and effective level, some of the lessons, painful lessons, that I've had to sort of swallow over the last 17 years of my recovery. Thank you for a lot. Because I suddenly realized, it's like, wait a minute, some of this shit just comes second nature to me now. It's like, do that. Don't say that. Don't curse this one. Don't hit that one. It's like, it's become kind of second nature to where it's like, don't resent your parents. Don't spit on the plate that you were fed from. And it's like, I don't have to think a lot about that or pray to God, please don't let me resent my hate my father. It just comes natural. It's like, I don't hate my father.
Thanks for listening to the More Than Ordinary podcast.
For more information, please go to our website, 7GenerationGames.com. And that's 7 as in the number 7, GenerationGames.com.
If you'd like to learn more about math and history, or increase your vocabulary while at the same time having fun, you can purchase our games at 7GenerationGames.com/buy.
You can also donate and help a much-deserving student.
And as always, please tell a friend and don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
It's never too late to be more than ordinary.